when we all went and visited one of the prisons? I didn't go because I have like repressed memories.
The House side of the joint committee.
Okay, now we go. Okay. We're on now.
Okay. I did. Okay. Called a House portion of the Judiciary Committee to order.
And I'll call the Senate and Interim Judiciary Committee to order.
I'm opening a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures for the 2016 session. Please remember that a vote for the introduction is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself, nor is it indicative of a member's opinion or position on the contents of the concept. Channel, can you give us an overview, please?
Certainly, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'll be very brief on LC-211, as we're going to go into it in a little more detail later today. LC-211 incorporates two major changes to the statutes concerning juveniles. The first is affixed to a bill adopted in the 2015 session. That was House Bill 2320, and it implemented an automatic hearing process for juveniles who have been adjudicated for sex crimes for the purpose of determining whether the juvenile must register and report as a sex offender. In the 2015 measure, a drafting error led to some juveniles not receiving their hearings and not registering. So LC-211 provides the technical fixes to implement the measure as it was intended in 2015. The second component of the concept is an update to the juvenile record statutes by the Oregon Law Commission. LC-217 is your Oregon State Police statewide tip line, and you've had some fairly good briefings on that up to this point.
Do you want me to make a motion for you? Chair Barker, I move to that we move LC-211.
Introduce
LC-211, 217 as committee bills.
Representative Olson moves to introduce LC-211 and 217 as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you.
All right, and the Senate's going to open up a work session, but before I do that, I do want to make one introduction. We do have Senator Rosenbaum, who's joining our team on the Senate Judiciary Committee during the interim, and I expect that she hopefully will want to stay after we get through this short session on the duration for preparation for 2017. So with that, I'll go ahead and open up the work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills for the 2016 session. And as Chair Barker said, the same applies to us. Please remember any vote that we take today on introduction of a bill concept is not a vote on the merits of the bill itself, and that each member retains their opinion and position to look at each of these during deliberations as we take these bills up during the 2016 session. Please note at this point, let's see. Looks like there says, note the letter from President. Okay. There is one other purpose that I need to make you aware of. Normally, a committee has only three bills to its charge. We have had a special consideration of getting a fourth bill based on the President's office authorizing LC-22 to be filed as a Senate judiciary measure. And so with that, Channel, why don't you give us an overview of the four bills that we will be introducing today.
Certainly, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. LC-22 is the grand jury recordation bill. You'll hear a little bit more about this today, so it'll be very brief. This is a product of a work group that met during the interim, and it requires all proceedings before a grand jury to be recorded, either through digital means or by a certified shorthand reporter, if a reporter is requested. It has staggered implementation across the state. It may only be released if the grand jury returns a true bill or a not true bill in the case of a grand jury proceeding involving a public servant. The measure contains protections for sensitive information, such as confidential records related, unrelated to the charge, or personal information of grand jurors and witnesses. It allows for protective orders limiting access to the recording or transcript. It allows the use of testimony for impeachment purposes, but contains three areas in which a peace officer may introduce hearsay testimony. If the witness is under 15 years of age, if the witness has a disability that prevents communicating or understanding the proceeding, or if the witness is a domestic violence victim who is unavailable at the time and the testimony is likely to be presented under the current domestic violence hearsay exception. The grand jury recording or transcript is considered a confidential document and may not be released under a public records request. LC 250 allows a specific group of people, including healthcare professionals, close family, and teachers, to make a report to the Oregon State Police when they believe a person is a danger to self or others. A good faith report generates a hold within OSP's firearm unit that prevents the person of concern from purchasing a firearm for a period of 30 days. The individual is not notified of the hold, and the identity of the reporter is not disclosed. If the individual attempts to purchase a firearm within those 30 days and is denied, the individual may remove the hold in two ways: documentation from a healthcare provider that the individual is not a threat to self or others, or a petition to the court. Knowingly making a false report within this statute is a Class A misdemeanor. LC 251 is relating to healthcare instructions. This is the product of your work group on advanced directives. It is, at the moment, a consensus document. It updates and simplifies the appointment of the healthcare representative and allows a Rules Advisory Committee to create instructions on healthcare. It phases out the current form in 2020 and allows for development over time of that form. LC 252 is relating to crime. This is another one we'll hear more about today. It has two concepts embedded to it, within it. The first is an extension of the statute of limitations beyond 12 years in cases in which there's additional corroborative evidence of a crime. The evidence must be physical in nature, but not DNA. We already have an unlimited statute of limitations for that, such as an audio or video recording, entry in a journal, letters, telephone recordings. It also allows confessions or oral or written statements from another witness that are contemporaneous with the report of the crime, or the commission of the crime, excuse me. It also allows for an unlimited statute of limitations when there are multiple victims alleging the same crime. At that point, it can go to an unlimited statute of limitations. The second section of LC 252 adds new language to the Assault 3 definition.
All right, thank you. Senator Rosenbaum, you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this like carrying your freshman bill?
It is. Introduction to the committee. Welcome aboard.
Thank you for the welcome. This fulfills a lifelong dream of mine that if I could not play a judge on Law and Order, I wanted to be on this committee. So. Mr. Chair, I move to introduce LC 22, dated 1/15 of 16, LC 250, dated January 12th of 2016, LC 251, dated January 15th of 2016, and LC 252, dated January 14th of 2016.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum moves for the introduction of LC 22, dated 1/15/2016, LC 250, dated 1/12/2016, LC 251, dated 1/15/2016, as well as LC 252, dated 1/14/2016. Is there any discussion? Senator Thatcher.
Well, I notice a glaring deficiency on the agenda that LC 250 is not listed on there. But besides that, I have a question about whether the versions we are introducing today will be the ones that are actually on the bills, or is there going to be another?
No.
Okay. I just want to make sure that if there are amendments, that they be done through their regular amendment process.
Oh, they absolutely would have to be.
Okay. All right. Good.
Any other comments?
Well, I'm not going to be voting for 250. I just want to say that. Not that it'll matter.
All right. Well, we have the introduction for all four of these coming in one block. So mm-hmm. Did you want to separate out the votes? Or
I don't care. It's up to you. I'll just be, whatever includes 250.
Okay. You have no preference? Because I'd like to just move through. I can just do it as a batch.
Do.
Okay. So, as I said, those have been introduced. That's what the motion is before us, is for all four of those LCs to be introduced. Any objections besides Senator Thatcher? Not seeing any. So ordered. And they are now introduced. And I think at this point, Chair Barker and I are wanting to open it up. We're going to have some different individuals coming forward to give us an overview informational hearing on these specific bills. Not all of the ones that are been introduced on either side are going to be informational today. My caution to those who are presenting today, as you can tell, one, we're on a Friday. Two, we're now at 2:20, Three, there are a lot of individuals who've been here for 3 days and they're ready to head back toward their districts. So brevity is very important. This is not a time to be persuasive speaking. This is informational. You'll have your opportunity during the public hearings to do all the persuasive speaking and advocating that you'd like when we have open public hearings. Thank you. And with that, we'll go ahead and open up an informational meeting, and this is going to be getting an overview as to the improvements to the State Penitentiary Behavioral Health Unit. We have Colette Peters and Bob Jundal that are going to be presenting.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski and Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters. I'm the director of the Department of Corrections, and I am here today, as Senator Przanski pointed out, to discuss the changes at the Oregon State Penitentiary. I have submitted my written testimony, so at the direction of Chair Przanski and in the interest of time, I've actually pared down my conversation to about 5 minutes before I kick it over to my colleague, and of course, happy to answer any questions along the way. In recent times, evaluating how the mentally ill are served in prison goes back to at least 2003 with the governor's mental health task force. Then we looked at both short-term and long-term planning for the treatment of mentally ill inmates. In the decades since, DOC has implemented many recommendations and made many changes, some of them including the creation of specific mental health housing units and also then creating step-down units to more smoothly transition inmates from crisis back into the general population. We've provided staff training and we've updated many policies and procedures. The long-term recommendations really put the department on a glide path toward Junction City to really become a purpose-built facility to house these special populations. Now with Junction City not needed for approximately 10 years, this conversation with DRO became even more imperative. We really appreciate the long-standing collaboration and relationship that we have with Disability Rights Oregon, and we have had a memorandum of understanding in place for years that allows them access to our facilities, our records, and our staff. So when DRO contacted us in August of 2014 to begin an investigation into the behavioral housing unit at OSP, we cooperated fully. They had some concerns that had been brought forward by some of the adults in our custody who were actually housed on the behavioral housing unit, or BHU as we refer to it. This unit is our intensive behavioral management and skills training unit for the adults in our custody with serious mental illness who also have committed very serious acts or disruptive behavior while in our custody. They are some of our more difficult population. In May 2015, DRO released the results of its investigative report, and their report concluded many things, including that we were not providing sufficient out-of-cell or adequate mental health treatment options for the adults on this unit. And while we did not agree with all of their findings and conclusions, we really did welcome the opportunity to focus on improvements on the adults in custody assigned to BHU, as we are always looking for those process improvements and systems improvements as new research comes and new information comes. And so having this advocacy group and this group of experts here to assist us really opened our eyes to new opportunities. We certainly, as I'm sure you did not either, want to engage in costly, protracted litigation before agreeing to similar reform, which has happened in other states. We instead conducted a comprehensive review of this unit that included consultation with a nationally recognized expert that we brought in and ongoing engagement and discussions with DRO, and we created some improvements to BHU. The results of that review are incorporated into a memorandum of understanding, which we've given to all of you, so I won't go in great detail, but I will tell you that among those improvements, we have committed to changes that will allow individuals who are assigned to BHU significantly more out-of-cell time, and half of those hours will actually be structured time with a qualified mental health professional. We will be working to improve training, not just for our clinical staff, but also for our security staff, and there will be more data tracking and recording. These improvements will require us to make architectural, operational, and staffing changes that will come at a cost. So the MOU actually reflects our collective understanding that the changes will require a formal request for funding and will actually come forward this February with that request. I would like to add that while many of these improvements will take some time to implement, we have made immediate changes to BHU in the meantime. We've removed the window louvers from the inside recreation area, which has really brought in a whole lot more sunlight when they're recreating. We have made some cosmetic changes simply by painting. We brought in new recreation equipment. We are providing musical instruments. We're expanding the unit library. We're changing shower time and rec time on the yard so they could utilize those both more often. And we're actually allowing treatment during count. And we believe these changes will go far beyond BHU. And in the interest of time, I won't go into detail talking about those now, but would like to later, because I really see this having a positive domino effect on all of our special housing units inside the Oregon Department of Corrections. I've already seen firsthand some very significant changes in our intermediate care housing unit, which is our step-down unit from our mental health infirmary unit already. And we have been awarded a grant, which is allowing Vera to come in and study and analyze our use of special housing and to recommend ways to safely reduce their use. So as we move forward in making the improvements, we have agreed to in the MOU, we remain committed to our collaborative relationship with Disability Rights Oregon and also committed to keeping you all apprised of our changes. In closing, I just want to add that I really am proud of our collective work and relationship, and I am especially proud of our staff at the Oregon State Penitentiary who really stepped up to make these changes happen and are responsible for carrying out this work on the ground. So with that, I am happy to turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Junda, or answer any questions that you might have.
Why don't we go ahead and take the testimony from Bob, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. I've submitted written testimony. I won't repeat it. I think the points I'd like to make, because Director Peters, I think, gave you a very good overview of the situation, and I don't need to repeat it. When we conducted our investigation, we found conditions that were troubling, in some instances shocking, and we brought those to the Department of Corrections. And to their credit, we were able to open up a dialogue that has already started a process of change in that unit, and we anticipate more positive change in the future. Our concerns are based upon two fundamental principles, and one is the constitutional rights of the people in the institution, and secondly is just their humane treatment. And of course the recognition that people in prison eventually do leave prison in most cases, and that the treatment that they and care that they receive when they experience severe mental illnesses and have problem behaviors associated with those illnesses, those behaviors should be addressed while they are in the custody of the Department of Corrections. The last thing I want to note is that the memorandum of agreement that we have come to is not a legally enforceable document. And so any inmate in that facility is still able to bring a legal action for their individual situation. And if we're unable to make the changes that are necessary, there can be other legal actions in the future. However, we don't anticipate the necessity for that. What we've seen thus far has been very positive, very collegial, and we think it will succeed. What we hope to do is to come back to you in the upcoming session to support the request for additional funding to make this plan work. Why do we need additional funding? Well, one of the problems has been that where these folks are now housed is a very restricted environment, and that the plan to
to allow them to have more mental health services and to have a more an environment in which they can get better is going to require more space, and it's going to require more staffing. And the space and the staffing are not only important for the treatment, but they're very important for the safety of the staff who work there and the inmates. And so this is a complete package, and we hope to make the case to you during the session. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions regarding this overview? Thank you all very much for coming forward. We'll close that informational hearing. We're going to go next to our grand jury recordation, LC-22. Chana, I think you're doing the lead on that.
Chair Krasinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, if you don't mind, I'll just stay here and tell you about this bill. So as you may remember, in the 2015 session, we had several bills dealing with recording grand juries. None of them were ultimately passed. Under the direction of the Senate President, a work group has met throughout the interim to work on developing a draft based off of Senate Bill 822. This work group included representatives of the Oregon District Attorneys Association and OCDLA and was chaired by Senator Przonski. LC-22 requires all proceedings before the grand jury to be recorded, either through electronic recorders in the room or through a certified shorthand recorder if one is requested. The information that is recorded includes the case name and number, the names of the witnesses, each statement made or a question asked by a prosecutor, and the questions and answers given by witnesses. What is not recorded includes deliberations, clarifications on the law by the jury to the court, technical procedures related to production and unsealing of documents, and confidential records that are unrelated to the alleged crime. The measure implements in two steps. The first is larger counties by October 1st, 2017, and all other counties by July 1st, 2018. The audio recordings and transcripts are considered confidential but can be released in a few specific situations. They may be released when they are requested after after a true bill was returned and at least 10 days from the date of arraignment have passed. Those 10 days are for the purpose of requesting a protective order on that information, and the measure outlines in great detail the procedure for requesting the protective order and how it can restrict access to the transcript or recording. The measure prohibits giving the transcript or recording to the defendant or anyone other than an agent assisting in trial preparation. Identifying information of the grand juror and witnesses, such as address and telephone number, are prohibited from disclosure. Unrepresented defendants may get a copy of the transcript or recording by requesting it of the court. The prosecutor in the case will receive a copy of that request to the court and has 7 days to respond and request a hearing on the matter. After the hearing, or if no hearing is requested, after the motion, the court may set reasonable conditions on the review of the transcript or recording. If a no true bill is returned on a public servant, a person may petition the court for a copy of the transcript or recording. Those are the only situations in which a not true bill can be released. And a court will balance the public interest in disclosure against the interest in maintaining the secrecy of the grand jury proceedings. The measure allows 3 instances in which a peace officer may bring in testimony of another person. That's when a person cannot readily understand or communicate in the proceeding due to a physical disability or a developmental disability, when the victim is 14 years of age or younger, or victims of domestic violence if the victim is unavailable at that time, and the statement is likely to be offered under the current domestic violence hearsay exception. Then a peace officer may give the testimony on behalf of the person. Failure of the audio equipment does not invalidate the prosecution, and as I mentioned, the recording or transcript is exempt from public records disclosure. Any questions?
Any questions from anyone on this concept? Not seeing any, we'll go ahead and close that informational hearing. And our next one is going to be dealing with probate update. We have Laura Hansel and Lane Shutterly that are going to give us their brief overview. Just a reminder, Lane.
We know you want to hear about probate assessment.
Yes, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Hansel, and I am the Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Thank you very much for having us here today. I'm going to start with some very brief comments about the commission for those who are not familiar with our work before turning it over to our chair, Attorney Lane Shetterly. So the commission does exist by statute. We are the nonpartisan, neutral legislative reform body for the state. We've existed since 1997, and we're charged with conducting a continuous process of law reform, I like to add, to the benefit of all Oregonians. We also exist via a very special public-private partnership between the legislature and Willamette University College of Law. We enjoy a beautiful home at Willamette's law school, and this gives us the opportunity to also engage in important educational work. So we're doing this through externships and developing even an Oregon Law Commission legislative clinic at the law school to be able to take law students under our care, mentor, and educate, and get them excited about law and policy work. There's a lot of information on our website about our process, but very briefly, we start with project proposals that may be generated internally by staff, may be done in conjunction with staff or legislators, or may be coming from a private citizen or an attorney or an agency representative. Those project proposals are taken under consideration by our program committee, which is chaired by former Attorney General Hardy Myers. From there, the project proposal goes to the full commission, which of course includes Chair Przanski, and it takes, again, taking it under advisement to see if that is an issue that is appropriate for the commission to deal with, and looking at the breadth of the project and what the final outcome would be, whether it's a report or some sort of legislation to bring before you. But that, again, that's in short about the Oregon Law Commission, and I'll let Lane then talk about the substance of this measure.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Przanski and Representative Barker. Lane Shetterly, for the record, Chair of the Oregon Law Commission here today. First, I want to thank you for sending Laura over to us. We hated to lose Wendy Johnson at the end of last year, but I've been very pleased to have Laura join us as Deputy Director now, and I know she's your loss, so thank you very much. LC 61 is a continuation of our long march through the Oregon Probate Code. It is actually the second of what would be probably a three- or four-part revision, wholesale revision of Oregon's laws relating to wills, intestate succession, and probate administration. Last session, we had Senate Bill 379, which dealt primarily with wills and intestate succession. This LC deals with primarily Chapter 111 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which is primarily definitions. And then conforming amendments in other chapters where we have modified definitions that relate to, that appear later in the probate code. Also, some discrete provisions relating to county courts and circuit courts as courts of having jurisdiction over probate, and the appointment of probate commissioners that some counties use to help manage the workload of probate cases. That's really all I want to say about the bill, except that to point out that it does have an emergency clause, except that the emergency clause is only applicable to two sections. That is, most of the bill takes effect on January 1st of 2016. We do have an emergency clause because there is one correction and one cleanup of Senate Bill 379 from last session. Since that is in effect already as of January 1st, we wanted to make sure that those patches took effect as soon as possible so that we don't have a gap in the effect there. So we have an emergency clause on this, but for all but those two sections, it's a delayed effective date until January 1 of 2017.
17.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Any questions for the panel? Thank you all very much for giving us the overview. And I do want to just make one other statement. And Lane, if you could, and also Laura, I just want to acknowledge the opportunities that Willamette University has given to us to actually be housing the commission. Being a member of the commission for a number of years, it has kind of been circulated at different law schools. Clearly, from my perspective, even though I'm from Eugene, I do believe having it at Willamette is very vital, because it does have such a great connection to the legislature, so many of our members can actually participate at the school when we're having commission meetings. And it's also, I think, a great segue for the students there at Willamette to actually have access here to the legislative process. And so I see this as a win-win, and I hope that Willamette will continue to be gracious enough to continue to house us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a Lewis and Clark grad myself, I concur with your comments. And also, I would be remiss if I didn't thank Representative Barton on the record for giving us the vehicle to move this bill forward. You know, the vehicles are difficult to come by in the short session. He was very gracious in offering this to us to move LC 61. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we'll close that informational hearing. We'll open up our next one, which is dealing with the definition of physical injury, LC 89. Senator Laurie Montes Anderson, Representative Olson, and Jeff Rhodes are going to be our presenters.
You sit in the Senate.
Yeah, we need someone to kind of insulate the House from the Senate.
Okay. Good afternoon, chairs and members of the committee. I'm Senator Laurie Montes Anderson, representing the Gresham area, and thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about LC 89, which deals with the definition of physical injury. It's adding fractures, cuts, punctures, bruises, and burns to the definition. And this LC is going to protect our most vulnerable citizens in our communities. It is a problem. Victims who cannot speak for themselves are not being given adequate protection under the law. And folks who are on the front lines working against child abuse and elder abuse also see the need for this, and hopefully you'll look upon it favorably. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm state representative out of the Albany area. Thank you for this opportunity and to work on this bill also with Senator Montes Anderson. I'm going to be really quick here. Obviously, when we get to committee concerning this bill, we'll go a lot more in detail what this is all about. But there's some significant gaps that exist in the law today. And as a committee, we have seen the horrific photographs of severely beaten infant child whose abuser was acquitted as a result of this gap in the law right now. Because the victim was unable to articulate the pain they suffered, the state could not prove the case. This needs to change. Again, we're talking about the most vulnerable population, as Senator mentioned, who cannot speak for themselves. This proposal is simple. We want to apply an objective definition of physical injury to those victims who exist in this special class, namely children, dependent persons, and victims of elder abuse. We have borrowed from the animal abuse statutes, which is ORS 167.310, subsection 11 is what we're really looking at, and we're just taking that same definition, Mr. Chair and committee members, and applying it now to the most vulnerable. That's all it is. It stands to reason that we should, at the very least, protect those persons who cannot verbalize pain in the same fashion. In fact, we have... Okay, so I mentioned that. That's it.
Wonderful.
Any sense going any further?
And doing cleanup?
And I need to leave, but I do want to thank Gina Williamson Skinner and Dana Vitalins, besides Jeffrey Rhodes, for helping work on this. So thank you.
Chair, may I ask a brief question?
Yes, you may.
Does the bill still have in it, or the LC still have in it, automatically defining anybody over 65 as a vulnerable person?
Chair Spazansky and Barker and Representative Greenlick, it does, and I'm going to go into that in just a minute here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
So with that, Chair Spazansky, Chair Barker, and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Rhodes. I am the legislative liaison for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm also here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And first, I have to thank Senator Montes Anderson and Representative Olson for allowing us to have a vehicle to bring this very important concept to you today, which is the update to the definition of physical injury. Really, there are, and I am going to be very brief today, as we've said, we're going to have a lot more time to talk about the details of this bill, but there are three things I'd like the committee to think about as we go forward in discussing this legislation. And those three things are, number one, for LC 89, we heard the committee's concerns with our original proposal that we came to this committee for loud and clear. We talked about them amongst ourselves and tried to figure out a way to properly address the committee's concerns. I think that LC 89 does address those concerns and represent that, so I'll get into that in a minute. This is a very narrowly focused piece of legislation. It is just protecting protecting a very small class of victims. We're talking about folks that are our most vulnerable victims that already have protections under the law, and I do want to stress that. And that gets into my third point. We're not creating law out of whole cloth here. This is in every portion of the LC. We are borrowing from other portions of the criminal code to make certain that we're not just making stuff up as we go along. These are tried and true definitions that exist in the code. So. Just for the first point, as to the committee's concerns, one of the big concerns had to do with domestic violence victims in the definition. That is out. That is no longer in LC 89. While we certainly have concerns about those cases, we really wanted to get to the heart of what we were trying to do here, protecting the most vulnerable folks in our communities, and that we thought that LC 89, more narrowly tailored to just deal with dependent persons, these are folks that we, and I'll talk about the criminal mistreatment statute in a minute, we're borrowing from that statute for our class of victims. To narrow it down to that was appropriate given our focus for this legislation. So that is point one. Point two, how narrowly focused this piece of legislation is. We do not think that this is something that's going to open the floodgates. It's going to create a whole bunch of new cases. And I'll explain to you very quickly why. The majority of the cases that we have talked about in front of this committee were cases that were at the trial level, convictions. The jury trial had voted to convict in those cases, and they went up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals overturned the case. The reason is this committee's seen the pictures. They've heard some testimony about those cases. These are cases where juries want to do something. They want to help. They want to try to do the right thing. It's only because of a unique interpretation of our definition of physical injury at the appellate court level that we've been running into problems. So that's what this seeks to address. Those cases are already going to trial because these are the type of victim cases where we just can't turn a blind eye to them. They're too egregious, they're too serious, and these folks are really in need of our moving forward with the cases. So I'll say State versus Wright, State versus Anderson, the cases that we talked to you about, those were ones that were overturned at the appellate court level. And now for my last point, Representative Greenlick, you had asked if there was a portion in this for folks over 65. We are still including that in there. The reason is, if you look at the criminal mistreatment statute 163205, that's where we're borrowing our definitions from. And we want to do that because we want to make certain that it lines up with other portions of the code. I looked into, to address your concerns, other portions of the code that deal with elder crimes, as well as other states that deal with elder crimes. And what I found was California, Indiana, Connecticut, and yes, Oregon as well, all have special victim designations for elders over 65 with the same definition. In fact, Chapter 124 in Oregon is a whole chapter that deals with this issue, with increased penalties for these types of crimes. So we've decided to keep that in because our law already recognizes this class of victims, and we want to make sure that we are consistent across the board with this. My last point, and then I'll take any questions, is just as Representative Olson said, this definition of physical trauma, it comes from the animal abuse statute. It comes from 167.310 sub 11. Again, we're borrowing from other portions of the code to make sure to take advantage of jurisprudence that exists currently so that we're not just creating law out of whole cloth. And with that, I'll take any questions that the committee has.
All right, questions?
Just for the record, I'll be discussing this when it comes to us in due course.
That sounds great. Thank you for the heads up. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to be Senator Thatcher and Chana. I think you're going to be helping out. This is on criminal impersonation, LC 101, and you can stay here.
Sure. Let me start.
Yes, please.
Oh, okay. Well, this is just basically a bill that builds upon identity theft statutes, and its financial element is what's been mostly been determined to apply in cases involving identity theft. This would apply to cases where the use of another person's identity is being conducted not with the intent to defraud, but with the intent to humiliate, harm, or harass. And there have been some egregious things that have happened that only could be prosecuted after the damage was done and not able to stop these horrible incidents from happening. So that's just the long and short of it.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, and Senator Thatcher did a great job summarizing this. I'd like to add on that this bill had a lot of input from the Department of Justice, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the ACLU, and the EFF. You have testimony from the Department of Justice on it, on this subject on OLIS for you. This addresses cases such as a stalker going online and posing as the targeted victim and inviting third parties to come over to the victim's house and participate in sex acts. The victim has no knowledge that this is happening and has not consented to this. There are numerous cases of this happening around the country and in Oregon. As Senator Thatcher mentioned, this is not currently covered under identity theft or computer crime statutes because those are implied to have a financial element in it. In these crimes, nobody's seeking money. They're just seeking to humiliate and harass. The elements here, I'm just going to lay them out for you, is a person intentionally impersonating another individual without consent and with the intent to injure. The impersonator acts with the intent to deceive a third party into believing that person is communicating with the individual. And a reasonable person in the third person's shoes would believe they were communicating with the victim. And the victim was injured as a result of the impersonation. Injured, as defined here, is to intimidate, harass, threaten, or physically harm. This would be a Class A misdemeanor. And in addition, the measure cleans up a current statute called criminal impersonation and defines it a little bit better, which is criminal impersonation of a public servant. Any questions on LC-101?
Any questions? Thank you all for the presentation. We'll close that informational hearing. We're now going to go to discipline of law enforcement officers. Representative Peluso is here, and she's going to give us an overview for LC-160.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker. Thank you for this opportunity to give this brief overview. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, representative for House District 50, Gresham, and a small portion of Southeast Portland. By now, I believe you are all familiar with my 30-year background in law enforcement. I appreciate the opportunity to give a brief introduction of LC-160 to the committee. This LC may seem familiar to you all, as the concept was part of a larger bill brought forward by Senator Boquist in the regular session, Senate Bill 743. LC-160 would improve employment conditions and increase basic fairness for Oregon's law enforcement officers and ensure that public safety officer discipline is linked to a violation of law or policy. While it is important that police officers and prosecutors work well together, our justice system demands that these groups function independently of one another. Many prosecutors maintain lists of officers about whom they have information that is required to be disclosed to a defense attorney. This information may range from significant transgressions to trivial personal decisions and is maintained completely at the discretion of the prosecutor. These lists are generally termed Brady lists, or sometimes impeachment lists. Some police officers have been disciplined for appearing on a Brady list, even if their reason for appearing was not in violation of any law or policy. An officer's employment relationship is between that officer and the law enforcement agency. The prosecutor is not a party to that employment relationship, and therefore, actions taken at the discretion of the prosecutor should not directly impact an officer's employment status. LC-160 presents disciplinary action being taken upon an officer solely for appearing on a prosecutor's Brady list. I want to be very clear about what this bill does not do. Does not affect the prosecutor's discretion in maintaining their own records. Does not impede the discipline of officers who have violated law or department policy. Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak to you about LC-160. My aim this afternoon was to keep my comments intentionally brief as I look forward to expanding on this policy at a future public hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and close that informational hearing. Our next informational hearing I have scheduled, I'm looking around the room, not seeing, I think, everyone that I expected to see, but I'm going to go ahead and call it out. This is for Elder Abuse Fatality Review Teams, LC-270. I see Representative Hoyle, Representative Gillum, and then Ellen are supposed to be the presenters.
They'll be here as soon as they can.
Oh, well, we'll put that one on hold, and we'll see if they're still around.
Our hardest testimony in another committee.
If we're still around when they want to come in. So with that, we'll drop down to wrongful death cap increase. Arthur Towers is supposed to be here, and is Mr. Towers?
Next door testifying.
Oh, well, we're getting through this agenda pretty quick, aren't we? So we'll drop down to sexual assault forensic evidence kits. I do know Senator Gelser is here, as well as I believe Brenda Tracy is also here, and staff will also be helping. So
can I stay here?
You can stay here. Brenda, why don't you come on up? You'll be okay.
You're good at this.
And so, Senator Gelser, I assume you're going to start off laying the groundwork?
So LC-197 is our sexual assault forensic evidence kit bill, which many of you at this dais have worked on. The sign-in sheet is moving down the dais. Everyone is invited to be a chief co-sponsor. The bill looks backwards and asks the state police to develop a timeline of when the backlog of testing on rape kits will be completed. And looking forward, it creates clear timelines, 7 days to pick up from the hospital. Oh, here comes the sheet. 7 days to pick up from the hospital and 2 weeks from the time they're picked up from the hospital, they must be delivered to the state police. It provides for matches to be uploaded to CODIS beginning in 2018, and it ensures that victims have a right to be informed of the status of their kits. Finally, it increases the length of time that a kit is kept for up to 60 years, and there is a task force that is established primarily to look for and apply for grants that can help pay for the testing and the uploading of these programs. There are more details, which we'll get to in the session. A lot of people have worked on it, and thank you especially to Chana and Brenda and Jackie Swanson, who may or may not be in the room, who's put a lot of work into this.
Yeah, I'll just keep it really brief. Also, we're calling it Melissa's Law. We're honoring.
Brenda, I need you to put your name on the
record. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Hello, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Brenda. Sorry, I got a little too comfortable. My name is Brenda Tracy. The bill is also going to be called Melissa's Bill, which will be then Melissa's Law. Melissa Bittler was a young girl who was raped and murdered in 2001, and so we're honoring her with this legislation in her memory. I hope that as many people as possible will sign on to this bill and support this bill. It's very important to survivors. I think the biggest thing we're doing with this legislation is sending a message to victims and survivors that their cases matter and that we care about the fact that we have over 5,000 kits in our state that are untested. So I think this is an opportunity for us to do some healing as a state, and I just am very thankful that we were able to bring this bill during a short session. So thank you.
All right. So is there – okay. So the only other thing, I want to thank Brenda Tracy for being part of the work group and her advocacy for victims and for survivors of moving this type of legislation forward. I also want to recognize and acknowledge Senator Gelser for being willing to do this as a personal bill. The reason we wanted it to be a personal bill as compared to a committee bill is to allow each and every member to consider signing on as either a chief co-sponsor or as a sponsor if they chose to do so. And as a Senate personal bill, it allows for both chambers to sign on individual members as chief sponsors. So hopefully those who are still in the building who would like to will work with Senator Gelser's office in getting their names on the bill, and if they don't do it today, they'll be able to have an opportunity once we start having hearings.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and continue on our list of digital assets and LC-206. Lane Shutterly is going to be coming back up, and Susan Gravy will be joining Lane for this presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Susan Gravy, and I'm with the Oregon State Bar Public Affairs Director. We're here today with Lane Shetterly to talk about LC-206, Digital Assets Bill. This is one some of you may remember from 2015. There was lots of discussion about it, and there were concerns raised by the high-tech community and the privacy community. However, by the end of session, we were not able to reach consensus on how to move forward. Lucky for us, the discussions at the local level in 2015 was a launch pad for discussions at the federal level. It went back to the Uniform State Laws Commission, and they expedited their timeline to look at the act and try and revise it. So what you have before you in LC 206 is a revised version of the bill, which I think melds together the concerns raised from the advocates from the privacy community and high-tech community, as well as the concerns from the proponents, the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar. I will leave the specifics to Lane Shetterly to discuss, because I think he was involved at the national level. At this point, I think it's a good bill, and we are hopeful to move forward in the short session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chairs Barker and Przanski. I'll be try to be as brief with this bill as I was with probate. I am wearing a different hat. This is Lane Shetterly again. This time I'm here as a commissioner from Oregon to the Uniform Law Commission. For those of you who may not know, the Uniform Law Commission is an organization of the states represented by commissioners from all 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, and Washington, D.C. We draft legislation for states to adopt, and by adopting it, creating a system of uniform laws where uniformity is called for and appropriate and achievable. You may recall that as Susan said, we had the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets in the last session. The scope of that, or the effort of that, was to get at situations where, in the case of a power of attorney or a conservatorship or a state of a decedent or a trust, where the fiduciary, the agent, the personal representative, the trustee, or the conservator would have the ability to access online information, digital information, kept by either the decedent or by the principal or the protected person, depending on the circumstances. That bill came to you from the Uniform Law Commission. It was opposed nationally. There were introductions all over the country. It was opposed nationally by the high-tech industry. They actually introduced their own competing bill, the Peace Act, that you may recall, which was narrower in scope, substantially everywhere. And I think there may have been one exception, but those bills basically drew to a draw around the country, and we got through the end of the legislative session last year, kind of bruised and battered, both sides, and neither having accomplished what they wanted in advancing their bill. So, as Susan said, over the summer, the drafting committee of the Uniform Law Commission got back together with the representatives of the high-tech industry in particular and worked out an amendment to the act, which is before you in LC 206 as the revised Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. I'm pleased to say that we have letters of support from Google and Facebook for this act, on the condition that the states not make substantive amendments to it. I think it's natural. They had approved the deal as it was reached through the Uniform Law Commission and approved by the Law Commission last summer. So what you have before you is a faithful rendition of that revised Uniform Act that is supported by the leaders of the high-tech industry. We have letters from privacy advocates as well. As a compromise bill, I will tell you that it doesn't go as far as I wish it did in terms of giving fiduciary access. However, it also accomplishes more than no bill would do. And so we are supporting it. And we urge you to adopt it without substantive amendment, just because that is the close nature of the consensus between the advocates on both sides. I'll be glad to give you more information to that when we have the hearing, but I am pleased to bring back to you what looked like was going to be a long slog that developed into a consensus compromise product that we were able to achieve over the course of the summer to bring back. I think there are going to be at least 25 introductions around the country this year, some in already, so we'll be early adopters, but it looks like most of the country and many states are going to be moving quickly to adopt this while the consensus is fresh.
Wonderful. Questions? Comments? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close that informational hearing. Our next one is on juvenile records, juvenile sex offender registration, LC 211. Laura Hensel again, Julie McFarlane, and our own Jessica Menifee.
Thank you.
would like to start?
Sure, I'll start. Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committees, Jessica Menifee from the Office of Legislative Counsel. I'm here to talk about this juvenile sex offender portion of LC 211. The important thing to know that this is essentially a fix to House Bill 2320 from last session. 2320 did a lot of things concerning sex offenders, but the most relevant thing was it really changed the way that the court decides whether or not a juvenile registers. Pre-House Bill 2320, when the youth was adjudicated, the court basically directed the person to report as a sex offender within 10 days of their release on probation or from incarceration, and then they had to thereafter register unless they obtained relief by petitioning the court. The intent of 2320 was to flip that so that the youth wouldn't be told at the time of adjudication that they had to register. Rather, the youth would be under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court or the PSRB for a period of time, and then when that jurisdiction ended, there would be a hearing, and at that hearing, the court would decide whether or not the person registered. And the actual burden of proof was the same in that the youth had to prove by a clear and convincing evidence that they were no longer a risk and didn't need to register. So that part stayed the same, but it was really the timing and whether or not there was this hearing that happened. So House Bill 2320 did that, but in a very simplistic way. And I'm using a passive voice, but I was the drafter, so this was my doing. basically, it changed that, and it created this hearing process and the hearings are supposed to happen within about 6 months of the person coming off jurisdiction. But the problem is really it didn't account for people who were already adjudicated, already off jurisdiction, and people who were already adjudicated and were still on under the jurisdiction of the court on August 12, 2015. And that's the effective date of 2320. So LC 211 fixes this, and it's the result of a lot of meetings and a lot of drafts and a lot of input over the last few months. And it basically divides up juvenile sex offenders into three groups. There are the pre-August 12th folks. Those are people who were long ago adjudicated, and they are off jurisdiction. And for those people, the old law applies. So we're getting back to the old law where they have to register. They've already been told to register. They've already been registering, and this just restores that situation to those people. Then there's the people that were adjudicated prior to August 12, 2015, but were still under the jurisdiction of either the juvenile court or the Psychiatric Security Review Board on August 12, 2015. And the agreement on those people was that they were already told to report or register when they were adjudicated, but these people will get a chance to request a hearing of the sort that we're talking about for the new folks, so that they get this other process where they can request a hearing, and then the court decides if they're going to continue to report. And then the people who have who were adjudicated after August 12, 2015 are going to continue under this new scheme. And basically, within a certain amount of time of their jurisdiction ending, there's going to be this hearing process. And for those folks, we really just made adjustments for the timing of things, record sharing among all the different departments, and really the timeline of when all this would happen. And the new type of hearing that we're creating for the people that are kind of in between 8/12/2015 and now, that's in Section 3, if anyone was curious.
All right, thank you. Who's next?
So that will be me. So Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, again, for the record, my name is Laura Hansel, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. So thank you for having us back, and special thanks to Chair Barker for fitting this juvenile concept, the juvenile court records fix, in with the original LC 211. So we're going to take you through this very briefly. Julie's going to start providing some history, and I'll go through some more of the substance. But I did want to just make it very clear that we're here to only talk about the Oregon Law Commission's portion of this bill, and that is only the juvenile court records portion. Neither the work group nor the commission takes any position on the aspects that are outside of our work group's breadth.
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, my name is Julie, members of the committee, my name is Julie McFarlane. I am a supervising attorney at Youth Rights and Justice and a member of the Oregon Law Commission. I chair the Oregon Law Commission Work Group on Juvenile Records. This is the fourth bill that our work group is bringing to the legislature. The original cause for these bills was a request from the Oregon Judicial Department and their need to clarify the fairly messy juvenile records laws for implementation of e-courts. So we undertook that, and there was a bill in the 2013 session which passed, but there was a catch-all provision added to that bill at the last minute before it was leaving the commission, which we had not really had adequate time to work on. And that provision was held in abeyance by the legislature so that we could work on that. In the interim, there was litigation filed, specifically a mandamus among other cases in the Oregon Supreme Court. It involved members of the work group, and the commission represented various parties in that litigation, and so we were unable to proceed to complete this work until the Supreme Court finally ruled on that in December of 2014, and at that point it was too late for us to get something thoughtful done for the 2015 session, and so here we are finally with the fix to that catch-all provision that was in the original legislation. As is often the case with Law Commission and other bills, there also are other fixes we've had to make along the way, and there are some more fixes in this bill that are not as significant as the original catch-all language that we have fixed.
So with that, yeah, we're very happy to be before you today with what we really think is a bill that strikes an excellent balance between judicial discretion and also allowing for open courts. So this bill has been very well vetted. It's gone not only through our work group and our commission, but we were also able to, thanks to Judge McKnight and her efforts, able to receive feedback from over 30 juvenile judges who looked at draft language and gave input. So we're really happy with the result. And what we've done is we've changed the any other person allowed by the court. That language is now changed to any other person or entity because it may not be a legal person requesting the records. And so if somebody wants the records that is not already in a statutory list, of which there are four under this section, they can file a motion with the court along with a sworn affidavit or declaration under penalty of perjury, and they must then include in that a statement detailing the reasons why they need access to the record, the relevancy of those records to the case at hand or to that request. If there is any. If there's not, they can simply state that. And they must also explain how the inspection or copying serves the balance of interest the court must consider. The bill outlines a very nice procedure for notice and also time to give parties that might be associated an opportunity to respond or object to the original motion. The court may, if it'd like to, hold a hearing on the matter and will provide notice to all parties. I should also mention if the person making the original motion is not able to identify all parties associated, the court then will do that for them with the same timeline. So the court may hold a hearing, but it must then do an in-camera review to take the matter under consideration. And in that camera review, they will review the initial motion, plus any responses or objections they've received, and plus then they will take into consideration four important factors the work group has figured out that are crucial. They'll first of all look at the privacy interest of the child, ward, youth, or youth offender, as well as his or her family members, which is very important. There's often sensitive psychological evaluation information, home studies, things of that nature that may not have anything to do with the juvenile at issue, maybe a sibling, a half-sibling, what have you. The court will also take under consideration the interest of other parties in the proceeding, including victims. That was an important consideration, of course. The interest of the person or entity filing the original motion will be taken into consideration, as will perhaps very importantly, in light of some of the litigation that was referenced, the public interest. So as Julie stated, the bill does a couple other things. I don't know if you want to talk in more detail about a couple amendments we're going to try and fit in there.
Right. So we do expect to have a few amendments for this legislation. We are hoping to have amendments addressing the concerns of Oregon Public Defense Services and the Oregon State Bar that would facilitate them being able to perform their statutory functions of monitoring attorneys. And also we have some minor kind of corrections as well. The reason that we didn't get those into LC 211 is that we're needing to work with Region 10 in addition to state law governing confidentiality of juvenile records. Federal law under Title 4E of the Social Security Act governs confidentiality in juvenile cases, and failure to comply with Title 4E can result in loss of fairly substantial state funds. And so the consultation with Region 10 is necessary to assure that we're not going to be doing that with this legislation. But we do think we'll be able to complete the negotiations with Region 10 and have those amendments for you.
Okay. And just to clarify, too, we do actually have language drafted for OPDS, and we have received approval from Region 10 on that, as well as approval from the commission to add that amendment. The commission has also conceptually approved adding an explicit provision for Oregon State Bar, along with our other subtle changes we might make.
All right. Thank you. Any questions or comments for the panel? Ladies, thank you very much. We're going to close that informational hearing. It looks like we have our panel for the Elder Abuse Fatality Review Teams. So Representative Hoyle, Representative Gillum, and Ellen Klim, if you all three would please come forward. Okay, team, who would like to go first?
I will, Mr. Chairs. Thank you for having us. Vic Gilliam, State Representative, Silverton. In the next 5 years, we expect to have between 600,000 and 1 million Oregonians over the age of 65, including me. So the likelihood of elder abuse and neglect is increasing. The secret to any success we've had in this body has been because of a work group that Representative Hoyle and I co-chair and take all the credit for. However, it's the group, hardworking, very different points of view that have brought the bills in front of both of your committees. And you, both committees, have been great partners. We have another bill. It may not be earth shaking, but it's another analysis so that we can prevent elder abuse in the state of Oregon. This session, you've got in front of you 4013. A member of this work group, our own judge, Catherine Tennyson, brought this, and she brought it to our attention because of her experience with domestic violence cases that result in fatalities. So her suggestion of a multidisciplinary team to examine and analyze the circumstances that lead to these tragic deaths is an important step. Let's take that step. And I for details, I will turn to my colleagues, one from Justice, but first my co-chair, who many of you know has had an incredible experience someplace back east, and then what an education she got on the Senate side, preparing her to be my co-chair.
We try.
Nice job. And I believe there are many more chapters in Oregon's success that will involve Val Hoyle.
Thank you. And thank you, committee. I'm Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City, and I've had the great pleasure of co-chairing the Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group with Representative Vic Gilliam, otherwise known as the Vic and Val Show. But in reality, there are a lot of people that have done a lot of work. And every single session since we've had this work group, since 2011, we've brought something forward. And sometimes it's easy. It's always bipartisan, and it always makes a difference. And we wanted to make sure that this session was no different. So what we're doing here, it's a simple bill. It replicates the domestic violence and child abuse review teams. We're asking for the opportunity to allow for elder abuse fatality review teams. And this bill is the means to establish that team, but not require it in any of the counties. So this would be something that counties could opt into. And House Bill 4013 creates a statewide elder fatality review team that will be housed in DOJ. So as opposed to DHS, this will be moved to DOJ because they have the means and the resources to do these investigations. It would meet twice a year, investigate deaths that were caused by elder abuse, and then make recommendations to the Oregon legislature, because the way that we can make a difference is by getting this kind of information. It also authorizes counties to make their own elder fatality review teams if they want to, or have smaller counties join in the state elder review team. If you have any questions about the details of how this works, neither my good co-chair or I are qualified to answer them, but we do have Ellen Clem from the Department of Justice, and she is, as people back east would say, wicked smart.
Certified.
Certified, yes.
Ellen?
Chair Prozanski, Chair Barker, or Baker, I don't have anything to add to this
show.
Wonderful. Show, the Vic and Val show.
Yes.
So thank you for having me here today.
Thank you for being the stand-up and between the two, just to keep them separated so we could continue our business.
I may be regretting that. Yes. In the position of my seat.
You will. All right. Any questions for anyone on the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And I'm really looking forward to learning more about this. It's an extremely serious area, and I applaud the sponsors for their work. But I did want to ask Representative Gilliam if there are any provisions in this bill for abusive elderly Newfoundlands.
Don't get them started.
I'll defer to Representative Baker.
Thank you.
Sorry.
All right.
I didn't bring my glasses today.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Our next panel is going to be dealing with the relating to crime, and we have Jeff Rose that's going to present again, as well as Chana's going to also maybe lead off. I'm not sure how we're going to do it. Jeff, come on up. And we do have one other panel that's supposed to be presenting before we get through this set of informational. We do have one after we finish this that we had to put on in a timely manner for the docketing, which will deal with courthouse funding after we complete. So who's going to start?
I'll go ahead and start. So it's LC 252, and the first section is a bill that I worked on. Chair Prozanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, LC 252, the first couple of sections of this bill extend the statute of limitations in first-degree sex crimes. As you recall, in 2015, we doubled the statute of limitations from 6 years to 12 years, and Senator Prozanski promised a work group to look at this in more depth. The work group included Senator Thatcher, representatives from the district attorneys, Department of Justice, and criminal defense attorneys. Dr. Marsha Hall provided an academic and therapist lens to this discussion, while Brenda Tracy and Pastor Ken Garrett provided victim input. So it's a very collaborative group. The concept extends the statute of limitations beyond 12 years when there is additional corroborative evidence of a crime. There are three possible types of corroborative evidence, those physical in nature that are not DNA, such as audio or video recording, photographs, telephone recordings, etc. Testimony, such as a confession or an oral or written statement from another person made contemporaneously to the commission of the crime that corroborates the victim's report, or a report made by a different victim alleging the defendant committed the crime. This last section is going to need a little bit of reworking in order to get at the issue we're really trying to get to, in which there are multiple victims alleging a similar crime, not necessarily a different victim alleging the same crime, the same occurrence. So if this evidence is obtained by the DA, the DA may proceed with the prosecution at any time. This section of the concept also requires the prosecuting attorney to provide a grand jury with any evidence reasonably tending to negate the guilt of the accused, but failure to do so does not invalidate an indictment or a prosecution.
All right, thank you. Jeff.
Thank you, Chair Rosansky and Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Rhodes, again with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office as our legislative liaison. I am here this time to chat with you about LC 252 and specifically sections 2 and 3 to LC 252. Some members of the committee may remember when myself and Chuck Sparks from my office came to testify in informational capacity on this concept. What this concept is aimed at is a motor vehicle causing serious physical injury to a bicyclist or a pedestrian. Now, I want to be clear. I just got a chance to review LC 252 late last night, and we determined that it's a little too broad. We have some work to do on the language. So I want to be clear that this is a bill that is aimed at pedestrians and cyclists. It's not a bill that's a traffic accident bill. It's not aimed at cases where there's motor vehicle collisions. It's aimed at a very specific class of victims. Now, there is some good news on that front. We actually have designations for vulnerable road users already in our law that this body has passed legislation regarding. This is ORS 801-608, which defines vulnerable road user, and it increases the penalties when people get traffic tickets and the victim may be a vulnerable road user. It may include an additional penalty. It may include class time that somebody has to undergo in order to fulfill the court obligations. So there are portions of the law that we could easily borrow for to get at what we're trying to accomplish here, which is, of course, folks who are using our roads and that are at an increased risk to have some serious physical injury as a result of a motor vehicle. So we're going to be chatting about this a lot as we go forward, but one of the main points I want to make is that, as I said before, this is not a traffic accident bill. This is a bill that is intended to fill a significant gap in our criminal law. It's a bill that's intended to cover the scenario where a individual is severely injured and looks like they're knocking on death's door and they're able to pull through but have a serious physical injury such as a loss of an arm, a loss of a leg, something that's going to affect them for the rest of their lives. We want to make certain that these individuals can avail themselves of constitutional rights to restitution contained in our Constitution. So, and one other point I just want to make briefly is with regard to the standard here. This is a criminal standard, criminal negligence. It's a much higher standard than the civil law that we're dealing with. We're talking about somebody who fails to be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk, and there's a gross deviation from the standard of care, and then, of course, has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So this is a much, much higher standard than we're talking about in the civil realm, and I want to make certain that that's conveyed to the committee. That's all right, I have.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. And we talked earlier, and so you're not surprised by this, but I really feel it's important for this work group bill having to do with the statute of limitations for it to be a clean bill. And by itself, I have some, I guess, qualms with the addition of this particular piece. I'm not there yet as far as supporting that particular piece. Maybe I can be talked into it later, but having driven in Portland and Eugene and places like where there are a lot of bicycles, I feel like I'm just about this close to accidentally hitting somebody and being in that situation. It would be absolutely horrific, but anyway, I just really would like that separated out.
I appreciate that. Let me just give a comment on that particular statement. This bill is relating to crime. It's not uncommon for the one or both of the judiciary committees to have a bill with a larger, broader relating clause to be able to address issues that come up. We decided this is the approach that we would take because the limitation on the number of bills that are available, it was necessary to have these two concepts placed into one bill. I will tell you, and this is, I guess, for Senator Thatcher, there's already been another request for another topic dealing with death scene investigations where you have horrific video and photographic evidence that comes into that investigation where families are now faced with potential seeing that material being released in the public records, such as in the UCC. And you can expect that that will also be another component that will be within this bill so we can be dealing with that so we do not have to have all of those families in the UCC tragedy and others in the future to have to be, let's say, reminded through media and other access that people would get access to these horrific crime scenes. So it is one of those scenarios that when we have a limited number of bills, we have to do what we can to accommodate all the needs that we have, and that is why the chair was willing to have these combined. So with that, is there any other comments or statements? All right, with that, thank you very much for that presentation. We'll go ahead and close that work group. And at this point, because of a issue regarding timing of agenda notification, the Senate has a 24-hour rule where the House has a 48-hour rule. There was one measure that's going to be heard for the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee because we were able to post it timely. Unfortunately, because of the restrictions on the House side, it was not able to be posted for 48 hours. So I believe, Chair Barker, you're going to...
I will move the House committee into recess and ask the members to stay here and remind you we can't ask questions or anything because of the notification requirement.
And so at this point, we're now in session on the Senate Judiciary Interim Committee to take testimony on the courthouse funding bill, LC-214. So open up a informational hearing for the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. And ask Deborah Kafori and Chris Fick to please come forward.
Thank you very much, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, who are I'm not really supposed to even look at right now, I understand. I understand that there was some confusion, so I very much appreciate you staying here to hear this bill. My name is Deborah Kafori, and I am the Chairwoman of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. Like many communities throughout the state, Multnomah County has been working on replacing our outdated and dangerous courthouse. And along with the Association of Oregon Counties and county commissioners from around the state, we've worked to prioritize courthouse replacement projects and in previous sessions hashed out a 50-50 cost-sharing agreement with you all that has enabled counties in Union, Jefferson, Tillamook, and Multnomah to begin replacement work. These buildings are not only vital to their local communities as a place to administer justice and to adjudicate disputes, but they are a large source of revenue for the state. Every year, the Multnomah County Courthouse alone generates $40 million in fines and fees for the state. Even a minor earthquake could cause significant damage, potentially the loss of life, and take the courts offline for a long period of time. That's why we've worked closely with lawmakers from both sides of the aisle on funding a replacement to our seismically obsolete building. Over the last two biennia, we've received $32.4 million from the state. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And our legislative request in 2017 will be for $93 million. Our total request will be added up at $225 million, which represents less than half of the total cost of this new building. We understand that this request is going to require a huge lift, and that's why we've worked closely with legislative leadership to explore additional funding options, such as user fees.
Many court projects in other states are funded with a mix of user fees and state and local general funds. We believe this makes sense, particularly for a project of our size. The two most common sources of user fees are surcharges on filing fees and on traffic and parking citations. LC 214 would grant new authorities to counties that have received state funding for their courthouses, with the presiding judge of the circuit court given the ability to apply a surcharge to the traffic and parking citations, and the Board of Commissioners given the ability to levy a reasonable surcharge on civil filing fees. This authority would help not only Multnomah County, but other counties throughout the state who similarly need to rebuild outdated and dangerous courthouses. It would reduce the burden on existing state resources by providing you with additional funding options to assist other counties. We thank you very much for your support to date of our courthouse project and hope that you will consider this user fee proposal.
Thank you. And Chris, did you have comments as well?
Chair Brzezinski, other members of the committee. The only thing I would want to reiterate,
first name,
is Chris Fick with Multnomah County, is that we are open to other funding proposals. In our research around user fees, we did find that these were the most common two that were used throughout the country, but we are open to other ideas. And as the chair said, there are a number of other counties in the queue throughout the state, so we think this would not only free up state resources for those projects, provide a logical local source of revenue, but also allow the state to spend these resources elsewhere as needed.
All right, thank you. All right, for our Senate members, are there any questions or comments? Thank you all very much for being here and participating.
Thank you.
You bet. We'll close that informational hearing. And at this point, thank Chair Barker. Do you want to
reopen?
All right, so now we have our joint interim committee's meeting and back on the last that we have, and the last one is dealing with wrongful death cap increase, LC 171, and I have Arthur Towers, and it looks like maybe one other individual will be coming forward. And just to let you know, Mr. Towers, you are the last of the presenters of all of our presentations today, so welcome. That's a hint. Short, sweet.
Chair Brzezinski, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and that concludes my remarks.
Very good.
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, Arthur Towers of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
And I'm Patrick Block. I'm an attorney and a longtime member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
Thank you.
And our understanding is that we are here to briefly just explain the bill, and I'll turn over to Patrick to do so.
Yeah, this is a bill to increase the cap on non-economic damages in wrongful death cases from $500,000 to $1.5 million, and then add a COLA onto it for in the future. And that's the purpose of the bill.
All right, thank you. All right, this is a topic that we had before the committees, at least on one side of the chambers, this last session during 2015, so it's not something new, but it's something that's coming back for reconsideration. So are there any questions from either chamber committees? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here, and thank you for being very short and concise. And the persuasive discussions will occur sometime after February 1st.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, thank you.
All right. Anything else that we need to do for the good of the order?
See everyone February 1st.
All right. Senate is adjourning, and for all of those that are here, thank you very much for being here. Safe journeys and travels, and we'll see everyone when we get started on February 1st.
Okay.
Senate's adjourned. All right. Here we go.
It saves energy.
All right. Here we go.
It saves energy.